Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 1st, 2019. Communities from oil-producing areas in South Sudan say they have not received their shares from oil revenues.
The 2% not to be given to the governors, because once the 2% is given to the governors, we will not even know how this 2% is being used. We need a committee within the state to be set up to manage the 2% to be channeled into developmental projects, like, for example, infrastructure.
And Sudanese women are demanding justice after attacks during crackdown by the military in Khartoum.
There are evidence and many victims get to the service points of at different actors. We will continue doing that for both the support of survivors and victims and for preparation of the investigations.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Communities from oil-producing areas in South Sudan say they are not benefiting from oil revenues as required by the law. A policy analyst at the Juba-based SADIN Institute, who researched South Sudan's petroleum laws, says since South Sudan gained independence in 2011, the government has yet to remit funds for communities from the oil-producing areas. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
University of Juba law student Michael Gadkoru hails from Northern Lech State, part of former Unity State, says his community has yet to benefit from the oil produced in the state, but does suffer from pollution caused by oil production.
If you look at it, people are suffering, and some kind of human beings are being produced in the area due to the oil pollution. So we are not benefiting in actual sense.
Another University of Juba law student, Geoffrey Gao from Southern Lech State, says his community has not seen the benefits of oil production either.
Ever seen the 2%, we don't know where 2% goes. To manage the 2% not to be given to the governors, because once the 2% is given to the governors, we will not even know how this 2% is being used. We need a committee within the state to be set up to manage the 2% to be channeled into developmental projects, like, for example, infrastructure, which is road, school and hospital, so that the benefit is gotten by all the members within the state.
Article 178 of South Sudan's Transitional Constitution of 2011 states that the national government shall pay 5% of the country's oil revenues to all oil-producing states. It further states that of the 5%, 2% shall go to the state, while 3% goes to the communities. A report published by the South Sudan Law Society in 2015 indicated that oil-producing states and communities were to be allocated on average $70 million a year and more than $80 million annually of the estimated $4 billion the government receives annually from the oil exports. The report noted that the figures could vary depending on production levels and market price. MP Asa Abdul Salam, who represents Greater Melut in former Upper Nile State in the National Assembly, says lawmakers from oil-producing areas opened a bank account with the Bank of South Sudan 2 years ago to enable the government to deposit revenues. She says not one South Sudanese pound or dollar has gone into the account since it was opened. Akodao, one of seven members on a panel of lawmakers from oil-producing states and communities tasked to follow up on the matter, says when the committee spoke with Finance Minister Salvatore Garang, he promised that the government would deposit the money on condition that the leaders come up with development projects.
The minister said if there is no clear projects for this committee, he may not release the money to the community account. So all of us from parliament and governor plus the committee, we will sit with the minister and then we convince them, because you cannot plan while you don't have money in your account.
A report published by the Sud Institute in May 2018 showed the government owed oil-producing communities more than $380 million. Zakaria Ding, a researcher and policy analyst at the Sud Institute, says his think tank found the government has not remitted any money to oil-producing states areas since 2013.
The allocations or the percentages were not going as agreed upon. And then we did this study in the conflict, you know, after the outbreak of violence. Nothing has been going to them.
Despite those problems, Ding says the government must pay the money it owes oil-producing areas as guaranteed by law.
So if it has not been given, then whatever is not given is owed to them and should be calculated and given to them by the government. I don't think there's any question about it.
Asked to clarify whether or not the government has been remitting revenues to the oil-producing areas, John Dor, South Sudan's Deputy Finance Minister, had this to say.
Haven't yet found out that the information, whether it is true or not, I can't really say.
South Sudan produces around 160,000 barrels a day. Global oil prices are hovering at around $60 per barrel. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Sudan's Transitional Military Council announced today they have arrested 7 members of the Rapid Support Forces in connection with the killing of 8 students in El Obeid on Monday. General Kamal Omar, who headed the investigative committee into the El Obeid incident, admits RSF forces were involved in the shooting. Some Sudanese activists say they want the upcoming transitional government to ensure justice prevails for survivors of sexual violence. A recent report by a military-appointed committee to investigate abuses on protesters committed by security forces found no cases of rape. Michael Atid has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Nahed Jabrallah, head of the Sima Center in Khartoum, says women rights activists recorded dozens of rape cases that occurred in December until early June when security forces cracked down on protesters outside the military headquarters in Khartoum. Jabrallah says her center has provided the victims with health services and counseling. She thinks many women who suffered sexual violence will speak up in the days ahead.
As civil society, there are evidence and many victims get to the service points of at different actors, and we will continue doing that for both the support of survivors and victims and for preparation of the investigations.
Jabrallah says cultural norms often prevent survivors from seeking support because they are afraid of social stigma attached to rape. But she says some survivors back that tradition and spoke up.
The eyewitness, there are the victims who came out and spoke in very high courage, and the main lesson we learned from this experience that sexual abuse as a weapon failed in breaking the courage and the power of people on the streets, and that all people were encouraged more by what happened to continue the struggle for the real change in Sudan.
Jabrallah says none of the survivors have found legal support to file a case against the perpetrators in court, adding the victims do not feel safe to access justice in Sudan's current environment.
For all actors, it is very difficult to go to courts or to file cases in the absence of feeling of peace and protection. And this is one of the problems. So now we are waiting for protective environments that can help and encourage the victims to go for legal process.
Women's rights activist Naimat Abubakar says once it is established, the transitional government should consider setting up a justice mechanism that ensures justice for victims of Sudan's revolution.
The way that people have been killed, women have been harassing, reporting about rape. So I think this is the main task for the transitional government. And I think the justice, bring justice for the victim of the sit-in. This is the first thing. And then prepare the country for the election.
Right activist Manal Bashir says the transitional government should establish a commission to deal with women's issues in Sudan.
It has to take care of all issues of violation related to women. So they have to devote a sector or a department to deal with these issues, and this department has to be well structured, starting from the reporting, including the investigation, passing through how to deal with the case, up to the stage of the remedies for the case and what penalties has to be taken care of.
Bashir says women face a lot of challenges in Sudan but are being ignored by the authorities due to lack of functional institutions that protect women's rights. For VOA News, I am Michael Atid in Khartoum.
Rwanda briefly closed its borders with the Democratic Republic of Congo Thursday after Ebola cases were detected in the Congolese border town of Goma. Eugene Uimana has details from Rubavu in western Rwanda.
At exactly 2 p.m. Central African time, that's when people were again allowed to cross between Rwanda and the DRC. For several hours Thursday, the situation at the border appeared to have dramatically changed, as Rwandan authorities shut down nearly all movement between the two countries. The busy border crossing between the cities of Goma and Gisenyi was exclusively an exit for Congolese nationals leaving Rwanda. Now, although the movement is not busy as usual, people are crossing. Earlier, several Rwandan traders told VOA that they were denied entry into Congo. This 35-year-old man was asked not to be identified, described his experience. I woke in the morning, ready to go into the DRC. Arriving here, they said we are not allowed to cross the border because of Ebola. I tried to come to the border, but police officers pushed me back. Another man, aged 25, said the news came as a surprise to the many Rwandans who enter Congo each week to conduct business. He said they did not tell us when they will close this border. Rwanda's Minister of Health, Dr. Diane Kashumba, told VOA there was no directive to close the border. However, she said authorities are urging people not to enter Congo. The Rwanda-DRC border is not closed, because when these responsible authorities have their ways of announcing it, writing it. What we did is to strengthen strategies to educate citizens, telling them, if you can avoid to go there, don't go. The brief border shutdown came after officials said a one-year-old girl in Goma had contracted the Ebola virus. The girl's father died of Ebola on Wednesday. This was the first time the border had been closed since the Ebola outbreak began in Congo a year ago. The virus has killed more than 1,800 people so far. There have been no reported Ebola cases in Rwanda, but a total of 3 people have been confirmed as infected in Goma. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Rubavu, Rwanda.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, tensions are escalating between Shia Muslim group and Nigerian authorities. Find out more when we come back after this break.
Speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you run for public office, what would be your top political priority?
Politically, I think I would be a woman MP. I would put in place measures to ensure that women's financial abilities are explored, to boost their earnings and financial status.
To reform the health sector by renovating the hospitals and providing basic necessary needs at the hospital facilities.
to reduce the hardship and the hunger in the society, honestly, because I will use my office to create so many poverty alleviation programs.
My top political priority will be education for all, because education is the foundation for all the different development sectors.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
We now turn to Nigeria, where tension between a Shia Muslim group and authorities is growing after a court last week granted a permission to label the Islamic Movement of Nigeria a terrorist organization. Security forces clashed with the group as they took to the streets of Abuja to call for the release of their leader, Ibrahim Al-Zakzaki, who authorities have held since 2015. Timothy Obiazu has more from Abuja.
Mimuna Dauda's three children, two daughters and a son, are among more than 350 Shiite Muslims killed in the city of Zaria in December 2015. They were members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, or IMN, and had just returned from school when violence broke out between members of the group and the military as they tried to block a military convoy. Dauda remembers the military cracked down hard on the IMN, accusing it of trying to kill the Nigerian army chief. I got a call from my daughter that the military had shot her in the stomach and her sister in the head and set the leader's house where they were hiding on fire. When I called back, I could no longer reach them. They had burned with the building. Days later, authorities arrested IMN leader Ibrahim El-Zakzaki and his wife and have detained them ever since, despite court rulings for their release. Their supporters' sporadic protests and security crackdowns have left many people dead. Abdullahi Musa, a media head with the movement, accuses the government of deliberately trying to eliminate their leader.
This government doesn't want to free Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. They want him dead. As they tried killing him in his house, God did not allow them. Now, they keep him in their custody.
Zakzaki is facing murder charges for the death of a soldier killed in the 2015 clashes. He founded the IMN in the late 1970s, taking after a revolution in Iran. The group now claims to have over 2 million members. Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency, Garba Barry, says their confrontation with authorities is a breach of the law.
They have become like a law unto themselves in Zaria, where their political spiritual leader used to live, constituted themselves into serious public nuisances. No responsible government can watch when public order is being breached.
Nigeria's police blame the IMN for the recent escalation in violence.
We've seen protesters carry out unprovoked attack on law enforcement officers who are on legitimate national assignment.
A Nigerian court recently granted permission to label the IMN a terrorist organization, further raising tensions with the Shiite sect. The IMN rejected the label, and observers expect further protests, clashes, and victims. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
From Abuja, we come back to the United States, where a political firestorm over race has engulfed the United States, as President Donald Trump was hit with new accusations of racism on Saturday after he attacked a prominent African-American lawmaker and branded the majority black city of Baltimore an infested mess. when Barack Obama was elected as America's first black president in 2008, many believed it was a watershed moment for a country bearing scars of slavery. Just over a decade later, as the 2020 presidential campaign heats up, the divisive issue of race has taken center stage. Jeremy Mayer, associate professor in the Scar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and author of the book Running on Race, Racial Politics in Presidential Campaign, talks to VOA Larry Landon about why president is ramping up talks about race.
I think the president is behaving the way the president has always behaved, even when he was just candidate Trump, and even before that when he was real estate developer Trump. He speaks to an angry resentment within a certain group of white people, and he has been talking this way since the late 70s and the 80s. This is nothing new. This is the Donald Trump we've all known. What's different is now he's president.
Have you ever heard a president of the United States say some of the things that this president says regarding people of color, certain comments regarding the four women, congresswomen?
My first book is all about race and presidential campaign. And the truth is that there have been presidents who talk this way in private. Just this week, a new tape emerged of a conversation between Ronald Reagan and President Nixon when Ronald Reagan was just governor of California, in which Reagan says incredibly racist things about African delegations at the UN. It's important to note that when Nixon was saying terribly racist things, and when Reagan was saying them, they were in private. And so to find a president saying as bluntly racist things as Donald Trump is saying in public now, you really have to go back to Woodrow Wilson. You have to go back to Andrew Johnson, because this type of blunt racism, I would have thought was over.
Doesn't also sort of go against what America looks to stand for as far as equality, tolerance, you know, nation of immigrants, and what America actually looks like right now?
Well, I don't know how much it goes against America. I mean, America has a lot of racism in its past. So for a certain group of people, this is fine. This is not an issue. They don't even want it to be called racism, because for them it's not. It's just natural that you can tell people that don't look white that they can go back to the place that they emigrated from, or that their parents in many cases emigrated from. So I think that it goes against America's ideals since Martin Luther King. But much of American history is a battle over how racist we are. This is part of that ongoing battle about what it means to be an American.
But what it means to be an American now, as far as the way we look, isn't it true that at some point in the very near future, there will be more people of color than there are white Anglo-Saxons?
You know, it's very interesting you say that, because one of the successes, if you are a Trump supporter, of the Trump immigration platform is that it delayed that day when whites are a minority by a good 5 years. The reduction in immigration, if he's successful, is going to really reduce the percentage of America that is minority, and it will delay the day of white minority by maybe 5-10 years.
Why do you think that Republicans are willing to look the other way? But we did hear from religious leaders at the Washington National Cathedral in a rare public statement responding, calling his comments divisive. Why are so many others willing to look the other way?
You know, in the campaign, when he was running for president, there was a moment when he attacked a federal judge because the judge's parents emigrated from Mexico. He said, a Mexican judge won't be fair to me because he's Mexican. And then House Speaker Paul Ryan said, this is the textbook example of racism. But he didn't withdraw his endorsement of candidate Trump. And why today are so many Republicans silent in the face of what is obviously racism? It's only fear. Trump said these things. He's still at probably 87 or 90% support from Republicans in the electorate. So if you're a Republican senator or House member and you criticize Trump, that could be the end of your career. They're all going to face primaries if they are seen as critics of Trump. And the lesson of all the senators and representatives who had to retire rather than face primary challenges is a very, very sharp lesson that keeps people in line.
The president said to reporters that he is the least racist person in the world. Does he just not understand why his comments comments are offensive, or do you think he knows very clearly?
I think he is trying to maintain what we in the Academy talk about as egalitarian self-concept. Everyone wants to think they're not racist, even racists in America today. So in his heart of heart, Trump probably believes he's not a racist. There's another concept that's related to it, and that's called white fragility. And the idea that white people get hurt when they're called racist, Trump is really angry when people call him on his racism. It hurts, it seems. And so he's not acknowledging that anything he says is racist. But let's remember, when he says he's the least racist person, he's also said he's the most intelligent person. He's also said no one knows more about Iraq than I do. I know more about ISIS than the general. So I'm very skeptical about all of it.
Do you think this could be a winning topic for the Democrats running for president?
I'm not sure, frankly. I wish it was the case. This should cost him the election. But in this polarized environment, if the Democrats don't play this correctly, it's not going to hurt him.
What's correct?
I think that the way you attack Trump as a racist is, I think you have to make him seem like someone outside the American norm, that he doesn't stand for what America should stand for.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
That interview was Professor Mayer of George Mason University speaking to VOA's Laurie London. If you are listening to us from Torit, Rumbek, Yei, Yambio, please let us know. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202-630-8011. That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Yala Kitautu by Victoria Ole.
Yala Kitautu, Yala Kitautu, Yala Yala, Yala Kitautu, Yala Kitautu, Yala Yala, Kelly ni Najere, Yala ni Najere, Yala Yala, Kelly ni Najere. Yala, 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 yala,
we've been listening to Victoria Ole with the song Yala Kitautu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Kulusawa, yala, kulusawa, yala, yala, Sudan.